KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, March 31st, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebrich with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And it's been said by some that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. And well, today we're going to be talking about some of those fish that might actually be able to use that bicycle. We're getting terrestrial. We're talking about amphibious fishes today.
I wasn't expecting bicycle guy. That's awesome.
I didn't know what I was going to say, so I went with that.
Awesome. And we are very pleased to welcome Noah Bressman. We came across Noah's name when we were doing our research on the Pterygoplichthys episode. And here we are. We've got our wish. We've got Noah on the show, and he's joining us from Maryland, where he's an assistant professor of physiology in the Department of Biology at Salisbury University. So very warm welcome.
So I got to ask, Noah, you know, a lot of times when people get into studying fish, it's because they want to go into this whole unknown world below the surface of the water. It's not often that you run into folks that say, I want to study fish, but I want them to be on land. How did this come about? What spurred your interest in amphibious fishes?
I always had a passion for fish. I was born with a passion for fish. That's been my hyperfixation my whole life, finding facts about fish since I was like 2 years old. I was getting in college and I thought I want to do something like Shark Week kind of stuff because that was the most common fish kind of research you would see in the media because that's really all that was on TV. So I thought that's what all there was to do. And also it did look cool, like big sharks jumping and all that stuff. To help me kind of get towards that goal, the summer after my freshman year in college, I took a course at Shoals Marine Lab called Anatomy and Function of Marine Vertebrates. I was hoping to learn more about marine vertebrates like sharks. And in that two-week course, we had a week of coursework and then a week of little experiments to learn about vertebrates. And while I was trying to think of a project to do on fish, I happened to see a fish in the hallway. And I was like, wait, you're alive? How'd you get there? And there were these mummy chugs. And I actually have all this research tattooed on my arm to kind of remind me of my roots.
Another tattoo.
I saw a mummy chug in the lab about 10 feet away from a fish tank. And I thought, how'd you get there? If a fish were to jump out of a fish tank, it would probably flop around randomly and end up dead somewhere near the bottom, right below the tank, a few minutes later. But this was the next morning, and the fish seemed to have jumped out overnight, and it wasn't right next to the tank. It was quite far away, 10 feet away for like a 2-inch fish. I put it back in the tank. I was like, that was weird. And the next day, another mummy chug jumped out of the tank. It was a different one in the same spot, 10 feet away. And I was thinking, well, this can't be a coincidence now. I got to do my project on this. And we happen to have a little high-speed camera. So I put them on the table next to the fish tank. And I saw that they were doing this very stereotype behavior. They would land on their side. They would reorient upright, then rotate around, and then drop back down on their side and continue another jump. And they would do that in a very stereotyped fashion, what we now call a tail flip jump. And I was curious, if they're jumping from their side and landing on their side, why aren't they just jumping from their side again? That seemed like extra unnecessary steps. I got some hypotheses I wanted to work on more with these amphibious fishes and decided to see if I turn the lights off, will the mummy chugs move randomly or still find the water? Turns out they can find the water, and if you replace that water with aluminum foil, they'll move towards it. And so I figured out that mummy chugs will use vision to move from tide pool to tide pool over land, looking for reflective surface in their environment to navigate towards, which would usually be water in a tide pool. This led to my first like aha moment in science where connecting it all back to that first observation, that spot on the shiny tile floor where the sunlight first shined is where the mummy chugs were. They jumped out at night, moved towards that spot, breed there overnight. And then when the sun came up, that shot was nice and shiny, and they moved towards there thinking it was boring. Got all confused. It was like, aha, I figured it out. That's kind of how I got hooked into amphibious fishes.
That's super cool. What are some of the, I mean, this is kind of one of these introductory episodes where we talk about a really cool group of fish. What are some of the different species in this group? And is there a common characteristic other than them just being on land that makes them amphibious?
Yes. So there are a lot of different amphibious fishes. And the key thing that makes them amphibious is they do some aspect of their life, or they're capable of going onto land. Doesn't have to be a long time, can be a long time. Like mud skippers are known for being out a lot longer. Same with lungfish. But some fish we may not even realize are amphibious, like mummy chugs, or even a lot of different killifish species, mosquito fish and guppies are all quite able to move on land quite well. They only do that to like avoid predators and jump out of the water onto land and then hop back in a minute later. It's a wide spectrum of fishes, and we don't have a great number of it. I did a review paper a couple of years ago trying to figure it out, expanding off of a previous review paper. The problem is a lot of these groups that have multiple amphibious species are relatively undersampled. Like, so I haven't gone and put every single one of fish in this family on land or this family on land. And some of these include Fundulidae and killifish species, which is like 1,000 species of killifish. I also found in armored catfishes, I found 4 species, including Pterygoplycles. Some of those can move over land, and I tested 4 of them, and 4 of them can move, including some Hypostoma species. Plecos can actually move really well, perhaps faster than any other fish I've found on land. And they can do this in a really weird behavior that I got to coin called ruffling, after repetitive flipping. And using a variety of different weird techniques, like high-speed video, as well as something called a frustrated total internal reflection table, which I saw somebody at a conference using it to describe salamander flip contact during their locomotion, because it basically shines a light around the edge of a sheet of acrylic at an angle low enough that it does, it's called internal reflection because the light just bounces off in that light sheet until it makes contact with something and then illuminates that area. And so I was able to use that to kind of describe the fin fall pattern of the plecos. They basically use the fins on one half of their body and then alternatingly plant the fins on the other half of their body. And then they'll lift their head and tail up and fling it to move themselves forward with more of an inertia, like a kid pumping their legs on a swing set rather than actually propulsing. And then they'll reset, put their other pectoral and pelvic fins down on that one side. And if they're large enough, their tails touch the ground, and they can help push off a little bit with their tail when they reset. But the smaller ones, they are too rigid and their tails don't actually touch the ground, so they're not pushing off mostly. And so the large ones do something a little different than the small ones. And they're just repetitively flinging half their body forward, planting half their body, planting their mouth down, then lifting it up as they fling forward and then planting it back down again. But we couldn't call it like a modified crawl or walk or anything like that because it was so different. So me and my advisor had a heated debate on what we wanted to call it, and I conceded, and we went with ruffling after repetitive flinging, because the other words I was coming up with were too silly. But I'm like, it's a silly behavior, let's call it flooping. So it seems like Loricaridae in general, which has got like 1,000 species or more in it, some of them can move over land, so could a lot more of them move on land? We don't know. But some characteristics that are helpful for amphibious fishes to move over land include some ability to breathe air, even if it's a short period of time. They could do that through a variety of mechanisms, like cutaneous breathing, where you breathe through your skin. If you have thin skin and you're small enough and your skin stays moist, you can get enough oxygen that way. Some fish have modified gas bladders that they can breathe air. Some fish, like lungfish, just have lungs. Lungs actually originated in fish as an adaptation for life in low oxygen environments that branched out to lungs in tetrapods, whereas it converted to gas bladders to some other fish. Some have suprabranchial organs, or special organs above their gills with special fans and blood vessels to help them breathe. Anyway, just being able to breathe in general really helps you survive out of water. Not only that, having an ability to move over land helps. If you can get out of the water, but you can't go anywhere to get back, it's not going to be a good strategy to survive. And fish can move over land through a variety of different mechanisms. We have ones that use just their axial body, like imagine American eels. Those basically slither over land. You have very few that just use their pectoral fins, and those are the mud skippers that will just kind of crutch along on land, also with their pelvic fins a little bit. And then there's some that will use a combination of their fins and body to help them move on land, like snakeheads, walking catfish. Then there's jumpers like the mummy chugs. There's some weird ones like waterfall climbing gobies that have a suction cup formed from their pelvic fins that they can use to climb waterfalls. And some of them have suction cup mouths too that they can inchworm up. Some pterygoplichthys and other plecos in general in Loricariidae family can use their oral sucker to help them climb waterfalls. Like the Astrolepis genus is particularly known for doing that. And so there's a variety of different ways fish achieve this to move on land. So the key is being able to move on land and breathing air, and then also being in a habitat where you're likely to encounter land. Deep sea anglerfish and things like that are unlikely to have these behaviors. I was doing a study comparing intertidal shallow water sculpin species to deeper sculpin species, studying their evolution to be more towards being more amphibious, or at least be able to better withstand the forces of the intertidal zone, like the waves crashing. Tidal sculpins are able to move quite well with like an army crawl over land. And they, while they have light adaptations to stiffen their fins, it wasn't that much different than some of the deep water sculpins. And some of those had big blocky heads that we found when you put them on a slope, they would do this weird behavior that turned them into a wheel and they rolled downhill. And I was like, wow.
Oh my gosh.
But it turns out it's just an artifact. Like, they cannot move on land. It is totally accidental. Their head's just so big and round, and they try to curl up in a ball and they just roll. And yeah, so those are kind of three big characteristics of fish that are more likely to exhibit amphibious behaviors.
Awesome.
That actually dovetails well into the next question that I had for you, which is, you know, it's easy for some of these fish, like you mentioned mud skipper, and then why, okay, classify it as an amphibious fish. I get it, and it's clear that it's moving on land. Some of the other ones, like the mummy chug, and I do like that you brought up that study that you did with that one, but, you know, it could easily be some fish get dropped out, they somehow end up on land, and they do just kind of flop about randomly, and hopefully they get back into the water. So when you're studying this, what specifically is it that you're like looking at and measuring to determine whether this is, okay, this is actually a behavior that's repeated in different individuals over time versus, I mean, if you dropped a mouse in water, even if it's not technically an amphibious mouse, it'll do something like swimming to figure out what it's going to do. And I imagine that the converse is true when fish are on land. So yeah, how do you know that this is actually a behavior versus just a fish reacting to a new environment?
The key is looking at the patterns of movement. Some fish will try to swim on land because they don't know how to move on land. They often do what's known as a thrash, where basically they'll push their head and tail down like they're just trying to turn towards one side, like bend their body towards one side like they're trying to swim, and they'll just kind of launch them like straight up like a couple inches in the air and drop them back down, which if you are on like a slope, like a bank, that can help you get back in the water, but it's not going to help you move intentionally over land. And so a lot of fish, if they're just randomly stranded, your typical fully aquatic fish would just thrash and do all sorts of random behaviors hoping they get back to water. The key with amphibious fishes and their amphibious behaviors is they have like a stereotyped clear terrestrial locomotor behavior that is distinct from their swimming behaviors. An example is when I was trying to describe if northern snakehead's an invasive species, that there was a lot of fear about coming onto land and eating people's puppies and babies when they first were found in Maryland in the early 2000s. Nobody ever actually separated if they could actually move on land or if it was just fiction, and made tons of terrible horror movies about them coming on land and eating people. Anyway, in that study, I did some electromyography where I recorded from their muscles and I put them in water and recorded how they swam, and I put them on land and recorded them on land, and the muscles were doing different patterns of activity. So it was clear they weren't trying to swim on land. They were trying to do a different behavior to move around on land, and that's key. Even things like eels that essentially slither on land, they'll use like wider amplitude body movements and move a little bit differently than in the water. So the key is to be able to move on land, you need to use a different pattern than just trying to swim. And yeah, basically, actually, that's it. You just need to use a pattern that's different than just trying to swim. And sometimes that can be accompanied with enhanced terrestrial locomotor structures like the weird fins of mud skippers, or sometimes it's like something like a mummy chug that doesn't really have many adaptations on land. It's more behavioral adaptations to move on land. There's so many different ways fish can move on land, but the key is you got to be able to do it intentionally and repeatedly to be able to get anywhere. Otherwise, you're going to be a fish out of water.
Yeah. I'm curious. I'm thinking about like when I hold a fish and they have the slime coat that acts as a protectant. How are these guys protecting themselves from the elements? I mean, if they're moving on land, they're maybe encountering different substrates. Like how does this work in terms of how they protect themselves from the elements?
A lot of this is still unknown. So they have a mucus coat, and that helps protect them. I actually did a research project on this. It came out of my lab, but an undergraduate came out about a month and a half ago on amphibious fish slime. Basically compared snakehead slime to fully aquatic carp slime, and then we compared it to something without scales, blue catfish. All of them were invasive to the area, so it was great to get all of them, and they're also more sized. And we found that the snakehead slime was like four times as slippery compared to either the catfish or carp slime, suggesting that developing slipperier slime and perhaps more slime can help these amphibious fishes move over land better or protect them more on land, helping them lubricate without getting scraped up on land. There's only so much some of these can do, like a snakehead. The mucus may help prevent it from drying out along with the scales. But if you leave it out in the sun, it's going to lose water pretty quickly. So a lot of these amphibious fishes stay close to water, or they'll only come out like when it's rainy or wet out, or like floods. Like walking catfish come out when there's hurricanes in Florida, and they're all over the place coming out of the sewers, old storm drain grates and things like that. But it's really got to stay close to water, or in really unusual cases like lungfish, they'll bury themselves in the mud and cocoon themselves in mucus during the dry season and basically get encased inside of mud bricks until they get rehydrated and get reanimated. And a few fish like pterygoplichthys, those plecos, may have armor that may help slow the evaporation of water, but they're still fish for a reason. They just need to be near moisture at the very least to get their fins a little bit wet.
So far you've mentioned at the very least high-speed videography, this electromyography. What other tools are you using to actually characterize and then differentiate these behaviors that you see?
I like to specialize in basically low-tech, simple experiments that'll get at the questions I'm asking. And some of it's quite simple. Like, for example, mummy chugs, I want to see, can they use vision on land? I'll put them in the center of arena and put an object over here. And if they respond to that object by either moving toward or away from it, like I track the directions and figure out if they have an average direction that they go to or if they statistically move randomly. And so some of it is just making a diagram and mapping it out. Put an object here, spray paint a color there, put some foil there, turn the lights on and off. Maybe put a chemical over here for one fish, like a walking catfish. If it moves towards there, it can use like chemoreception on land. If it moves away from it, it can still also use that just it doesn't like that compound or it doesn't respond. It may not detect it. So a lot of them, I just use these simple behavioral assays and just collect the data by mapping these things out. Grids, measuring angles that they move, whether they're moving towards something or away from something. And even in the snakehead experiment with the slime, that was very low tech. We grabbed one of the force meters from the physics teaching labs that are very cheap and basically clipped it on a snakehead, dragged it back and forth on a table and on some turf. Wiped the slime off with a bunch of paper towels and then did it again to see how the mucus helped lubricate them. And we repeated that with those other fish. Here's a fun one. I did a study on walking catfish and I had to delay my field season a little bit because I tore my labrum of my shoulder in a rock climbing accident. And I had to wait till I got healed enough that I could do one-armed research in the field. I was limited in what I could do. I did some experiments visually, like those behavioral assays, exposing them to some chemicals and found that they can taste the ground to find their way around and can detect chemicals in the air. But I'm still trying to determine if it's like aerial smell or aerial taste, some other undescribed chemoreception mechanism that has not been described in an amphibious fish before. My lab's working on that. But I had to get creative, get some additional data. And I noted that a lot of people see walking catfish in Florida in rain and post videos out on Facebook. And so I was like, well, what if I just post in a lot of Florida wildlife-related Facebook groups and create a survey asking people, hey, if you've seen a catfish on land, tell me, like, what was the weather like? Was it rainy? Was it sunny? Is the ground wet? Was it dry? Was there any visible bodies of water nearby? Was it day, night, time of year, that kind of stuff? And even then, I was able to learn a lot. I got like 150 responses if I combined it with the YouTube videos I found. And I found things like, sure, they'll mostly emerge from the water under wet conditions when it's overcast, like in hurricanes, but also sometimes when it's dry and sunny. And so it's not always when it's wet. Seem to come out on land to feed in some cases. Luckily, I got a really detailed observation from a USGS wildlife technician that happened to be one of the respondees who was like, I saw 50 of these catfish in the road, and I took about half of them on my way home from work to make for dinner. And I noticed they're surrounded by a bunch of earthworms. And then when he cut open those catfish stomachs, half of them had earthworms in it.
Oh, whoa.
going there feeding on those earthworms. So maybe when the ground's a little bit moist or it's a little flooded, they are coming on land to eat those worms that we all know comes out of the ground when it's wet out. And one other interesting thing I learned through the survey is a fun one, is the walking catfish. Most observations appeared to be nowhere near bodies of water. Like, it wasn't like a nearby pond or anything like that. And based off of some videos I saw, it seems like some catfish are going into storm drain grates, either whether it's by the flow of water or they're moving towards it. I know they can use chemoreception to find distant bodies of water, so that could be another possibility. It seems like they live in the storm drains under Florida, where it always has water because it's always standing water because there's no topography in Florida. So water moves in these storm drains, not by gravity, but by more water coming in, flushing it out. So there's always water down there. And when it rains, that connects the surface world through the sewer world and the storm drains. And it seems like the walking catfish will emerge out of the storm drain grates to appear nowhere near bodies of water in like parking lots and streets, come onto land and feed on bugs and things like that, then return to the sewers or the nearest body of water as the water recedes. And so these are some really fun and interesting hypotheses that I was able to support with the survey data combined with some behavioral catfish data, but it's all pretty much low tech that I do.
That's super cool. That's very cool.
Normally when we talk about a group of fish, we're talking about a clade, everything descended from a common ancestor. But of course, that's not the only way to organize groups of fishes. And in this case, it's based on a behavior or a particular set of behaviors. And so what's interesting about that, I'm a big fan of, you know, instances of convergent evolution. Mm-hmm. What are some of the more fascinating or perhaps unexpected examples of convergent evolution that you've seen across these different amphibious fishes?
A lot of them have converged on similar ways of breathing on land. Like, I'll give you snakeheads and walking catfish are totally distantly related, but they both have these specialized organs above their gills that basically has just a lot of blood vessels and some fan-like structures to move air in and out. And they've convergently found this effective way of breathing on land. Gills will collapse and kind of stick together out of water, and most fish can't move air over their gills as easily. So they have less surface area for respiration and less air movement to help them respire, whereas developing fans helps you with the air movement, and having these structures that are supported in a different way than gill lamellae. There's like a tree-like organ above the walking catfish gills, for example, that has like a cartilage scaffold with a lot of blood vessels. And so that does not collapse out of water and they can breathe air. So a lot of them have converged on similar mechanisms of breathing air. There's also been a lot of convergent mechanisms for locomotion. So generally, things that are going to be more eel-like in shape are going to move more similarly on land, whether it's a rope fish or a American eel or even moray eels. Some moray eel species can feed on land. I think there's a BBC documentary showing them feeding on crabs. So they all move in a similar locomotor way with those body shapes. Some fishes will move similarly over land, walking catfish and those tidepool sculpins I mentioned. They use pectoral fins in their actual body. But there's been some really wacky cases of convergent evolution in like even more specialized areas. For example, some waterfall climbing gobies and plecos, like Astroblepis, some species within that neotropical suckermouth catfish family. They can use their mouths as suction cups to climb waterfalls to get over land. Those are completely convergent. My favorite case of convergent evolution is between Pterygoplichthys and some other armored catfishes and a fish called Cryptotora thamicola. It's a hill street native to caves in Thailand that's like blind and has no eyes. But they both have converged on having their pelvic fins and pelvic girdle attached to their axial skeleton in a way, similar to how tetrapods have their hind limbs attached to their vertebrae. Like if you look at our pelvis is attached to our spine. Other fish do not have that. Their pelvic fins are just loose in muscle tissue because they're just used for steering and maneuvering in water. But by developing that rigid connection with the axial body and the axial skeleton and those pelvic fins, it allows them to better support weight and better propel the fish on land. And while they move in two totally different ways, these are the only two groups I know that have convergently developed a connection between their pelvic girdle and their vertebrae to move on land. And they develop those connections in totally different ways too, which is really interesting.
What do you mean that they developed them in different ways? Can you expand on that real quick?
Yeah, so The Cryptotora thamacoa has like some modified ribs that help connect the pelvic girdle to the exoskeleton, including the ribs, pretty straightforwardly. These pterygoplectes and plecos, they have this bone called a laterotpterygium that's only found in that group of fishes. This laterotpterygium connects their pelvic girdle to essentially their armor on the outside. And so now it's connected to their armor. Then going up around the top, the armor is more or less connected, at least with like connective tissue, to paraneural arches. So most fish have neural arches, which is like a single spine coming off of their dorsal fin. But these plecos, they have paraneural arches where instead of one spine coming up of each vertebrae, they have two in a Y shape, which allows their pterygiophores, the inside portion of the fin rays that make up their dorsal fin, it allows those to sit between those two. And what that does is it kind of interlocks and creates more rigidity in the vertebra column, helping more rigidly connect the laterotpterygium and the pelvic girdle to the vertebra column. So in a really roundabout way, they go from pelvic girdle to laterotpterygium to their armor to these paraneural arches that come off their vertebrae. And that helps them support the weight on land better and better use more on their actual like body muscles to help them move more quickly on land.
That's fascinating.
Wow, that's wild.
What percentage of fish are amphibious? We talk about anadromous fish a lot, but you know, they're only like 1% of fish worldwide or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we talking about here?
So it's tricky because we don't know the diversity of them and we're still describing amphibious fishes each day. Like my lab this week is going to test out another fish that preliminarily checks all the boxes for terrestrial amphibious behaviors and preliminarily looks like mummy chugs moving around on land, but it's totally not related at all. And so we're going to test that out later this week to see if they can in fact move over land. But I would say given also like some very diverse groups like the armored catfishes that have multiple individuals that move on land, but we haven't tested each one of 1,000 or so, mm-hmm. I would say about at the absolute highest end, maybe 10%.
Wow.
Maybe 10%. I would say more like right now, ones that have been described, more like 2 to 3%. But a lot of these fish live in difficult to find areas like remote islands or in like swampy mangroves or in high stretches of rivers that may need to climb waterfalls and things like that. So it's a really wide possible range, but it's not just a couple fish. It's hundreds of fish, if not low thousands.
That's a great field to be in, it sounds like. Just for listeners, I know you've mentioned a lot of different fish. Could you just list some of the native ones in the United States and some of the non-native ones?
So some native amphibious fishes include mummy chugs, striped mummy chugs, and several other killifish, particularly in the Fundulus genus. They often live in tide pools along the shore, but also could include some other native killifishes in different groups like mosquito fish, which they're on the low end of the amphibious spectrum, but they can jump quite well on land. Other ones include American eels. You can argue Pacific lamprey because they can climb waterfalls. A couple others that I'm working on right now that I don't want to say it yet. I don't want to jinx it, but okay. Some of them have not been described for those. But we'll hopefully describe some more this week. Some intertidal sculpins in the Pacific Northwest can move over land, move between tide pools. And a lot of intertidal fishes like gunnels and pricklebacks that are eel-like can move over land as well a bit. The Hawaiian waterfall climbing gobies are also native and can climb. That's the majority of the ones that I know right now. In terms of invasive ones, we have the walking catfish, the northern snakehead, and there's also a few other snakehead species like the bullseye snakehead in Florida, and there's a couple others in Hawaii, and those can also likely move on land given they're in the same genus and have very similar natural histories. The plecos are invasive in Florida, like the pterygoplectes and hypostomus, as well as in Texas and some other regions. And then it also includes like some that may not be as widely spread. Like go to Florida, you can find so many different invasive amphibious fishes because all the canals and floods connect everything in Florida. A lot of killifish from the pet trade, like some guppies and swordtails, can move quite well on land. Arapaima have been found in Florida, at least some dead ones. And in that review paper, it's based off of a video I found online. It seems like arapaima can actually move quite well over land. And you also get like some bichirs that can be in the aquarium trade that can be released. Betas can be found some here and there in Florida that get released as well. There's Asian swamp eels in Florida too. So it's a lot of those aquarium trade fishes that can re there that get out in Florida and spread throughout Florida.
since you're talking about kind of these, you know, fish coming on land, I'm curious from a both a native species conservation kind of standpoint and then from an invasive species management standpoint. I mean, we normally think about water, but what are some land use considerations for these fish?
In that review I did on amphibious fishes, it was also about invasive amphibious fishes. And I did kind of a literature review and found that invasive amphibious fishes are about 10 times more likely to establish invasive populations than fully aquatic fish. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, they can disperse over land into new bodies of water, so they can quickly spread and colonize rather than your typical fully aquatic fish that can only move through connected waterways. There is a story that seems to suggest northern snakeheads got into a tributary of the Arkansas River and then eventually to the Mississippi River through amphibious behaviors. Back when the first snakeheads were found in Maryland, they're listed as invasive and injurious wildlife, and there was a fish farmer in Arkansas that was farming them because they taste really good. And so the guy was farming them legally until it's like, all right, it's going to be illegal to do it. It's like, all right, I'll kill them. Guess he didn't know that much about these fish. And also there wasn't actually even known about how well they could move over land or how well they could breathe air at that time. But he thought, I'm just going to drain these ponds and toss the fish on the bank. And I guess you can't hear the audibly swiping. Yeah, I'm swiping my hands, kind of cleaning the hands off, like job done. He tossed them on the bank and thought that would kill them. But imagine you're farming hundreds, if not thousands, of these fish. You put them all on the bank for a little bit, let them dry out and die. If there's a creek not too far away, the odds of a couple of them entering is pretty high. And it seemed like they got into a tributary of the Arkansas River, then the Arkansas River itself, and then the Mississippi River. So get ready to see snakeheads all over the country soon as they spread throughout that major river system. But there's also some other aspects of amphibious fish biology that make them more likely to be invasive, given these fish generally can breathe air, so they can survive in terrible conditions that other fish may not be able to survive in. These things live in like puddles that are evaporating, that are accumulating waste, and they be very acidic from a lot of decaying vegetation with high carbon dioxide and low oxygen, things like that. So in general, these fish are extremely hardy. And because these fish are extremely hardy, they transport very well. Whether you want to bring them in the live fish markets like snakeheads and walking catfish, because you can keep them in a bucket with no water and they'll survive all day and being fresh. Therefore, they're being transported around a lot more because they can tolerate being transported around a lot more. But also a lot of these fish are found in the aquarium trade because they can survive all sorts of conditions. So you give it to little Timmy who's never taken care of a fish and be like, here's a guppy or here's a betta, both of which can breathe air and move over land a little bit. Those are more likely to end up getting let go in the nearby pond if little Timmy doesn't care about raising those fish anymore. And that's happened to snakeheads and walking catfish species that were started off small and they're like, oh, they're too big. I don't want to take care of them anymore. And they're released. And so that's another problem with them as well.
And then kind of the follow-up with the native species, you've mentioned mummy chags, you've mentioned killifish. What are some things we need to think about from a land management standpoint, maybe to allow that natural movement?
It all depends on the natural history of each of these fishes. Some of these amphibious fishes require migrations, and some like Pacific lampreys are, I would consider them on kind of the low end of amphibious, but they can climb waterfalls with their sucker-like mouths quite a big, good distance. And they can also climb some dams, but there's been some research showing the limits of how high and how steep they can climb. So making dams or fish passageways that these native fishes can still climb over would be beneficial for them so they can survive. American eels, they migrate out of rivers to spawn each year, and then there's elvers, the little glass eels, migrate up and climb dams and waterfalls. Those ones also need to be paid attention to, as if they can't go inland, they can't go upriver or downriver depending on the times of their life. Effectively, they'll try to go around those obstacles or go over those obstacles, but there's only so much that they can climb and survive. So we got to keep that in mind in their conservation.
So I'm curious, when you're talking about testing new fish to figure out, okay, is it amphibious, and you're going to put it on the stage, what kind of considerations do you have to make? You know, when you take an animal out and you put it into a completely different environment, especially if it doesn't have any adaptations, what kind of steps do you have to go through?
These fish are approved by IACUC, Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. I usually come up with some preliminary evidence that suggests they can move over land or in a habitat that would be conducive to amphibious behaviors. And I usually start small. So I'm not going to be like, I'm going to put this new fish on land and see if it can move for 8 days without any water and see if it survives. I usually be like, I'm going to put it on land for a couple minutes and film it to establish the behavior. And if it tolerates it well, then continue with it more and up to like a maximum time frame dependent on. Like mummy chugs, we limit to like 5 minutes because they don't have as good air breathing capabilities as snakeheads. Whereas snakeheads, I've had them fully emerged and anesthetized, hooked up to electrodes, recording like their sense of smell and things like that, that can survive just breathing air for hours and hours because they have really efficient air breathing. And so if something has good air breathing qualities, I can use that to justify this animal is going to survive at least a short period of time out of water. Now, depending on the quality of air breathing mechanism, going to limit how long they're going to be on out of water. And we're not going to test them too rigorously. We're not going to exhaust them or dry them out. In general, a lot of the preliminary data that goes into some of these behaviors is, like, for example, with snakeheads, there's conjecture that they would move around on land when I described them because people would say they'd move around on land. And there's been some studies on other species of snakeheads 100 years ago that basically just dropped them on the ground and said, it survived for a day and it was able to wiggle a little bit and move a little distance. And so that wasn't a very good quality study, but I was able to use that to justify like, well, what if we set that up a little bit from there? Now, I had broadly limited to like fish that can breathe air or exhibit some aspects of behaviors along the shoreline that may lead them to stranding. Sometimes a good hypothesis doesn't pan out. We happen to have archer fish in the lab doing a project in my PhD, kind of studying how they shoot water and feed and jump out of the water at insects dangling above. And I was like, well, they jump out of the water naturally, like close to the shore on bug. What if they jump onto land and get stranded? Like we'd only put them on land for a very short period of time to film it. And I put one in our test arena and immediately it was a dud. It was clear, like this is one of the worst moving fish on land ever. It was so awkward, bulky. It kind of just flipped back and forth around like its like pointy mouth and it would just bounce back and forth like the mouth would stay in the same spot.
Oh, no.
The tail would hit one side and hit the other side and the other side. And it was like, well, 10 seconds later, put
check
it back.
That one.
All right, this is not one that moves around on land. So this is kind of some of the ways we kind of test new fish and make accommodations. The key is don't leave them out of the water too long. Do some background searching and use some observations you see in the field and you go from there.
Awesome. So Noah, if you had unlimited funds and you could upgrade your lab to have something additional, what would you want to answer maybe some of those burning questions you have? I don't have any funds for you. I'm just asking.
So I'm at a primarily undergraduate institution. We don't have as much fancy equipment as like a big research institution like Cornell or Harvard or anything like that. So I've kind of found my niche in specializing in these low-cost methods. And also my primary role is teaching and not research. So I can only do research on the side. So if I had unlimited funds, I would hire like a bunch of postdocs and a bunch of undergraduates and lab techs and master students to basically just allow me to do more research so I can do more of these discoveries. So I guess staffing more people would be helpful. If I needed a fancy technique, though, or like a fancy equipment, I would just go with the staffing situation because I like those simple experiments that don't need fancy equipment because I got ADHD. I like to be able to move from one simple project to the next simple project instead of like taking 10 years to build up one big project to see if it works.
Okay. That's awesome.
I know it wouldn't be a simple thing, I don't think, but I think it'd be cool to look at, see if the eyes are structured different. Because you're talking about like
how. Oh, they are.
Like if you took like a fungulus that's somewhat land adapted or we'll call it amphibious versus one that really doesn't display any of those behaviors, you can see that the eyes are different?
In some species. So it hasn't been tested on like that fine of a scale, but there are some amphibious fishes that are known to have adaptations to their eyes to help them see in air because air and water have different refractive indices so they can focus in differently. But there's a fish called the four-eyed fish, Anableps. It's not four-eyed. It has like split pupils that makes it look like it's got four eyes. But it also has these oval-shaped lenses where the light coming in from above goes to the flatter side of that lens to focus on the retina. And the images coming from water go to the rounder side of the lens to focus on the retina to help them see better in those different media. So I do think there may be some adaptations in the eyes of some like fundulus and some of these other fishes. And some have been tested. But when you think about it, if you're only partially amphibious, like you only come onto land a little bit, you're going to want to keep your eyes mostly adapted for water too, and there's a trade-off. So there's very few adaptations to eyes, but I think things like mudskippers do have some adaptations because they're so amphibious to their eyes as well.
That's cool.
Very cool.
Have you tested Alaska blackfish, their air breather up here?
I have not. but that is in the family of fish that I'm about to test this week.
Okay.
So we will find out.
Awesome. And then the final question I got. So you mentioned kind of crowdsourcing observations earlier with like these walking catfish and different things. Do you have any requests for listeners in terms of calls to action for you?
If you see any fish on the ground ever that have not been described to move on land, please send me some videos or the fish. If you're legally allowed to send me the fish, I probably need some IACA proof on my end to receive the fish at first. But especially if anybody has access to live arapaima, I am very looking forward to doing a product on live arapaima. But give me your live arapaima, the bigger better. I want to get a fish that's bigger than me crawling around on land and film it because I've got a hunch.
Awesome. All right, well, thanks. This was fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
A lot. Yeah. All right. Well, get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the amphibious fishes that we talked about today. And I would say to listeners, if you heard a fish that you want to hear more about that Noah mentioned today, let us know, and maybe we can do an episode on that in the future.
It's fun to join. It was like somebody sent me your last Terrible Pythies podcast out. Somebody's like, you have to listen to this podcast right now. I'm like, wow. Oh, it's your research. So thanks for the invite to the podcast. I was like, oh, that's fun.
You described ruffling a lot better than I did, so I'm glad that we got you to say that. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
FiberPlus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. An Alaska Native Corporation shareholders are questioning contracts that one of its subsidiaries has to run migrant detention facilities. That's as the Trump administration's immigration crackdown continues. Nana Regional Corporation's subsidiary Acoma has faced accusations in recent national news stories about the poor treatment of migrants at detention facilities it runs. Jackie Catalina Schaefer is a NANA shareholder and a former board member. She says there's been a lack of transparency from NANA leadership about the contracts.
You know, we are Inuvik from Northwest Arctic that are founded on Inupiat Iliqasait, which is our foundation of who we are. And those values do not align with any of this type of work.
A small but vocal group among NANA's 15,000 Inupiat shareholders agree with her. Schaefer helped craft a survey to gauge how other shareholders felt. More than three quarters of the roughly 100 respondents said they did not want a NANA subsidiary providing migrant detention services, even if it was profitable work. Acoma and its subsidiaries comprise NANA's federal contracting branch, and they generate a majority of the Alaska Native Corporation's overall profits, according to information presented at a recent shareholder meeting. Schaefer says there's a certain grim irony to the detentions and deportations, noting that Indigenous people were the original occupants of what became the United States.
Every single person who's not Indigenous to this land is an immigrant, or they come from immigrants. How do you decipher who you choose to send away? These are inhumane behaviors coming from our contractors. Regardless, it's you're choosing money over humane situation, so money over people.
NANA's communication staff and executive leadership team did not respond to multiple requests for comment. The chair of its board of directors declined to comment. Starting May 7th, every air traveler age 18 and older will need a real ID to board a flight within the United States. Alaska DMV manager Lauren Whiteside says her agency is ready to help any residents who still need to upgrade their ID. Whiteside urges travelers who plan to fly on or after May 7th to ensure they have a real ID. Without one, people may face delays or be denied entry at TSA security checkpoints, preventing them from boarding their flights. If you still need to obtain a real ID, you can visit your local DMV. For more information, visit dmv.alaska.gov. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping power the businesses that power Alaska with customized solutions. More at northrim.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason ruled last week that the Biden administration was wrong to cancel oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. As it happens, she did exactly what U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan says she never does, by deciding against environmental groups. Sullivan's recent criticism of the judge caused a stir in the legal community. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sullivan veered into criticizing the judge when he spoke to reporters at the state capitol on March 20.
I don't want to get specific, but we have a couple district judges that rule with the far-left radical environmental groups every single time. And that judge, in my view, has done more damage to our state than almost anyone imaginable.
Sullivan let it stand when a reporter observed that it was obvious who he was talking about because Sharon Gleason is Alaska's only fully active U.S. court judge. He went on to assail her impartiality again a moment later. He said the main thing he's looking for in the next judge would be someone unlike her.
We're not going to have another judge like the one that we were talking about. I'm going to make sure Alaska does not get a federal judge who sides with the far-left radical enviros on every case.
That is factually incorrect.
Attorneys like Jeff Feldman, who've appeared before Judge Gleason, says Sullivan is wrong about her. She does not always rule in favor of environmental groups.
I can say that both by looking at her history, as well as her personal experience, because she has ruled against me in environmental cases or against my clients.
To cite a few examples, in 2021, Gleason ruled against environmental groups trying to block oil leasing in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In 2023, Gleason dismissed lawsuits aimed at stopping Willow, ConocoPhillips' oil and gas project in the National Petroleum Reserve. And then on March 25, she issued her decision favoring a leasehold in the Arctic Refuge. Feldman, now a law professor at the University of Washington, did some research and says 81% of Gleason's decisions are upheld on appeal, a slightly higher rate than other federal judges who have served in Alaska. Feldman says he considers Sullivan a friend, but says it's inappropriate for him to, as he put it, throw rocks at a judge.
When a leader makes that kind of allegation that suggests that a judge's rulings are both wrong and politically motivated, that undermines faith and confidence in the judiciary.
Federal judges are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. By tradition, the senators from the state with the judicial vacancy play a big role. They usually select a candidate and send the name to the White House. For several decades, Alaska's U.S. senators have made their selection with the help of the Alaska Bar Association. The Bar Association collects names of applicants and then polls its members about them. Senator Lisa Murkowski likes the process. Sullivan doesn't.
One bar poll is not a reflective of what's out there, in my view, and I feel very strongly about that.
Case in point, Sullivan says, is Joshua Kindred's selection. Kindred was the district court judge who resigned last July amid findings of improper conduct. Sullivan praised Kindred at his Senate confirmation hearing, but speaks of him with disgust now and is quick to point out that he wanted someone else. Sullivan says the Kindred fiasco shows the need for more pre-nomination screening. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
This is Alaska Public Media.
How much do I owe you? Said the husband to his wife. For standing beside me through the hard years of my life. Shall I bring you diamonds? Shall I buy you furs? Say the word and it's yours. And his wife said, I won't take less than your love, sweet love. No, I won't take less than your love. All the riches of the world can never be enough. And I won't take less than your love.
How much do I owe you? To the mother said the son. For all that you taught me in the days when I was young. Shall I bring expensive blankets to cast upon your bed, and a pillow for to rest your weary head? And the mother said, I won't take less than your love. No, I won't take less than your love. All the comforts of the world could never be enough. And I won't take less than your love.
How much do I owe you? Said the man to his Lord. For giving me this day and every day that's gone before. Shall I build a temple? Shall I make a sacrifice? Tell me, Lord, and I'll pay the price. And the Lord said, I won't take less than your love, sweet. No, I won't take less than your love. All the treasures of the world could never be enough. And I won't take less than your love. I won't take less than your love, sweet love. No, I won't take less than your love. All the treasures of the world never be enough, and I won't take less than your love. No, I won't take less than your
this is what I'm that way. I wanna bop you, baby, all night long. I wanna bebop you, baby, till the break of dawn. I wanna bop you, baby, all night. I wanna bop you, baby, all night long. I wanna bebop you, baby, till the break of dawn. I wanna make it a night like it used to be, when our hearts were young and our souls.
I kept my